This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. We're getting out of the nation's capital a little bit today on the roundup. In fact, we're getting off the mainland altogether. There's big news happening in the two non-contiguous U.S. states. We will pay a visit to Hawaii and Alaska. But unfortunately, there's still so much happening in Washington that it's going to take us a while to head west. But we will get there with the help of today's panel. Joining us here in studio is NPR's lead political editor, Domenico Montanaro. Domenico, welcome back to the Roundup.
Hey there, thanks for having me.
Also glad to welcome back Eugene Scott, political reporter for The Washington Post. Eugene, welcome.
Glad to be here.
And joining us for the first time on the Roundup is Annie Carney, a White House reporter for Politico. Annie, welcome back to 1A.
Thanks for having me.
Let's begin with three Americans who had been held prisoner in North Korea. They were brought home this week, ushered by Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State. Many, if not most, of President Trump's supporters view their release as a major victory, along with the upcoming summit with Kim Jong-un and the withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal. Domenico Montanaro, let me start with you. What has the reaction been like here at home, particularly to these latest big developments?
Well, I mean, I think clearly this has been a political winner for President Trump. I mean, you've seen his approval rating on North Korea flip from even just 2 months ago. Over the last several months, people are saying that they're less fearful of North Korea being an immediate threat. So as the United States moves away from a nuclear standoff with North Korea, and you have the South Korean president saying that President Trump should get the Nobel Peace Prize, inevitably and unquestionably, that's going to be a political winner for him. And you wonder how much effect that'll have on the midterms. You've seen over the last several months, President Trump's approval rating in the Real Clear Politics average has inched up from about 37% in October to about 43% now. So clearly, there's some things in his favor. Now, we still don't know what North Korea wants, what this meeting in Singapore will entail or include. We know North Korea wants a lessening of sanctions and to be fewer troops on the Korean Peninsula from the U.S. The U.S. secured the release of those three prisoners. But what can the United States give? What is the United States willing to give? And is North Korea going to back away from its nuclear program?
I always worry about taking for granted what people know about the ins and outs of political poll watching. The Real Clear Politics, it's kind of a poll of polls. It's an average of the polls.
Yeah. And when you look at that poll average or you look at any of the other aggregators of poll averages, they show a clear trend in Trump's favor.
And I think that is significant for a few reasons. One, we know that globally, the United States under Trump has not looked incredibly favorable to people in the international policy world. And I think this move could show that President Trump is trying his best to show that he has some global diplomatic skills that can be reckoned with. I think the challenge for this White House consistently is them getting in their own way. When you have wins like this that can bring good press, it seems like less than 24 hours later, you have your chief of staff making comments about immigrants. You have other aides making comments about John McCain that end up dominating the headlines and taking away from this story.
Speaking of the press, Annie Carney, that's what I was going to ask you about. The press and the president's relationship with it was part of the story of this week. I wonder how you would characterize just the coverage of this week. I mean, the president had a number of big wins this week, not the least of which being the release of these hostages, at least in the eye of the president's supporters. What about the coverage this week?
The coverage this week looked at Trump as someone who is more growing into being himself, acting on the impulses that he wanted to in the first year, but he was more often held back by advisors like McMaster and Tillerson, who are no longer there. He's now surrounded by people who are less checks, Bolton, Pompeo. These are advisors who are now letting him be the America First president that he was in words only in the first year. And now we're seeing actions that he's following through. Withdrawing from the Iran deal is breaking with the European allies. Opening the embassy in Jerusalem is breaking with Arab allies. This is the president sort of delivering on what he said he was going to do and feeling more free to do that. So I think he's been covered as a man unfettered the way he used to be.
So the difference between H.R. McMaster, former National Security Advisor to John Bolton, his successor, from Rex Tillerson, former Secretary of State to Mike Pompeo, his successor, getting the team in place to let him kind of do what he said he would do as a candidate.
Yes.
Let's talk a little bit more about the relationship between the press and the president. I know we always run the risk of being a little navel-gazy when we talk about, oh, the president doesn't like us, meh. But on Wednesday, the president tweeted the following, quote, "The fake news is working overtime. Just reported that despite the tremendous success we are having with the economy and all things else, 91% of the network news about me is negative, in parentheses, fake. Why do we work so hard in working with the media when it is corrupt? Take away credentials?" Unquote. Domenico, is this just a threat or is this a real possibility? Like, what do we make of this?
You know, if
If anything, is this just like the ongoing argument between the press and the president?
I mean, look, politicians are always working the refs in a sports metaphor, and that's clearly what the president keeps trying to do. But, you know, the biggest reason why it's a big bluff is because if a tree falls in a forest, then no one's going to hear Trump, right? I mean, the fact is the microphones are things that he's been able to manipulate for the past, you know, three decades, frankly, to get himself attention. So without the press, he's certainly going to have a harder time getting his message out there. It is one reason why his campaign is toying with the idea of live streaming his events to be able to sort of filter the information. Maybe they only credential Fox News. Who knows? But the other kind of backlash that that would set off would be even more negative press that he doesn't want to have to deal with. One other thing here, he defined fake news finally. Fake news equals negative news about him.
Yeah, I also thought what was very interesting, one thing people don't realize is that we more than often cover what is happening. And so whether that is negative or not, it's not a reflection of reporters' bias as much as some people think it is, as much as some things are literally happening. That's what was said. And that's what was said according to sources in the White House, which is an important point. So you can take away credentials, which I don't think will actually happen, but you can't stop these people from leaking.
I think the worst day of Trump's presidency in his mind, I believe, would be the day he walks to Marine One and there's not a gaggle of microphones waiting for him to approach if he feels like it. And he feels like it a lot. We saw last week he did two gaggles on the way to Air Force One, one outside the White House and one at Andrews Air Force Base.
When you say a gaggle, just an informal gathering of reporters, just kind of crowd around and ask questions.
The pool of reporters. Right. And I think this is one of the features of the presidency that he loves. There is always within feet, within throwing distance, 20 or so cameras. That being said, it's not a complete empty threat. The Trump campaign did revoke credentials for many news outlets during the campaign, which really only led to like logistical trouble of getting to certain rallies for certain reporters. It didn't change actually covering him. I kind of see it as bark, not bite, because I think he likes the press. But if he did revoke credentials, I don't know if he knows exactly what that means. It would be a logistical problem more than stop an inability to cover.
So it might be another example of what people around the world see of President Trump, and that's speak loudly and walk with a small stick.
Well, and also I think there's a lot to be said for the fact that some of the president's media availabilities were kind of timed for coverage in a way. I mean, there was the 3 a.m. release of the hostages, which many people described as a made-for-TV moment.
Mm-hmm. He made a comment, this is the highest rating that anyone's ever gotten at 3 a.m.
Right. And then there was also the fact that, you know, he made the announcement about the Iran nuclear deal, but the first announcement was when the announcement was going to be. Typically, I think in a White House, you would just make the announcement, and it would be news in that moment. Mm-hmm. But he got about 36 hours worth of I forget when he announced the announcement and made the announcement, but all of that was additional coverage.
It's also a strategy, though. I think that the railing against the press speaks to his base. He uses the media as a foil, as an opposition party, like a candidate, and it is dangerous rhetoric in that it rallies up his supporters to distrust the mainstream media.
I do want to move on and talk about a few other things as we continue with the roundup. But one other person that I think has also been using the media this week, let's be clear, is Michael Avenatti. Stormy Daniels' attorney.
This week, right.
Since time immemorial. He released a memo this week stating that Michael Cohen, the president's longtime personal lawyer, received nearly $2 million from a number of companies after the 2016 election. Worth noting, one of those companies was AT&T, which apparently was looking for advice in its efforts to merge with Time Warner, something Donald Trump had opposed and vocally on the campaign trail. Just this morning, the Wall Street Journal broke the story that the top Washington executive and policy chief for AT&T was forced out of the company after paying Michael Cohen $600,000 to advise. AT&T's chief executive Randall Stephenson said in a message to employees, quote, "There is no other way to say it. AT&T hiring Michael Cohen as a political consultant was a big mistake," unquote. Eugene, I wonder if this is Michael Avenatti playing the press to get what he wanted. His story turned out to be true, and there's been a real-world repercussion.
Certainly. I mean, he, I think, is aware that there are issues that voters have with this administration beyond Stormy Daniels, and he has gotten significant coverage for his role in that. And I think he wants to pivot and help people see other areas of concern dealing with Michael Cohen specifically, such as him possibly being involved with some pay-for-play lobbying scenarios that would be illegal.
What more do we know about this, Domenico? And how have Michael Cohen's attorneys responded to these accusations?
Well, it's not just AT&T, right? And the AT&T suspicion early on was there any help with this merger? And apparently that's what they were looking for. But, you know, it also shows how limited the influence Michael Cohen had with President Trump, because the merger obviously was something that the Justice Department didn't approve. But Novartis, also the big drug maker, also paid Michael Cohen. And I don't know how I get on board something like this deal he had. $100,000 a month for a year.
That's a nice life.
For a year. And then met with him once and said he couldn't deliver. But instead of fighting the contract, they said, let's just let it expire because we don't want to upset the president.
So he gets $1.2 million, right. $100,000 a month. To pick his nose. And then shows up once and is like, sorry, I got nothing for you. And keeps the money and there's no harm, no foul.
Right. And, you know, for all of the, over-the-top outrage about the Clinton campaign and Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton taking money from various donors for the Clinton Foundation, that money didn't actually go to the Clintons themselves to enrich themselves. This was money that was going directly to Michael Cohen, literally just profiting off of his relationship and friendship with President Trump. So, you know, when you talk about swampiness, there's certainly some ingenuity there and also a great deal of swampiness involved.
Well, White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders addressed the allegations against Mr. Cohen at a press conference on Wednesday. She suggested that it was not the president's responsibility to evaluate Cohen's business practices.
I think that would be up to those individuals who make the decision to hire someone, just the same way that the companies that you work for make the decision to determine whether or not they think that you're qualified to serve in a position. That's the decision of an independent company and has nothing to do with the White House.
That was Press Secretary Sarah Sanders speaking on Wednesday. Also, Rudy Giuliani, who is now one of the president's top lawyers, he's been making the rounds on the media this week. He also denied the connection between Michael Cohen's business ventures and the White House. Giuliani told USA Today, quote, "I don't see it. This has nothing to do with us," unquote. Annie, what about that? Does this have nothing to do with the White House? I mean, there's so much going on in the legal thicket around Donald Trump. And to an extent, we do have to keep these things separate. They're connected, but they're not perfectly parallel.
Right. I think the reason everyone got so excited about the Cohen payments was that one of the payments was from a Russian oligarch. And it looks like this could be the first real connection between Russia, tying it all together, tying Russia to the hush money. The fact that Michael Cohen proved to be a inept connection to Trump and didn't deliver for any of these companies kind of makes the case that Sarah Sanders is trying to make a little bit for her, I think, in that people looked at him and thought he was a way to get to Donald Trump, and he really wasn't that lobbyist type that they hoped he would be. I think that these companies going to Michael Cohen shows who's, you know, he's a former taxi cab operator from New York and a real estate attorney. And AT&T is going to him and other companies are wanting advice about the Affordable Care Act. This shows how new and green Trump was to politics, how no one understood this guy and who was connected to him. And they went to Michael Cohen thinking he could provide some insight into Trump. And he didn't really have the access that they were hoping he would.
Well, I think I wonder, with regards to that, Eugene, what this means in a longer sense. I mean, I understand companies going to, I can fathom why a company would want to go to Michael Cohen as a kind of Trump whisperer. You know what they say about a fool and his money. Are we pointing to something that is just unseemly or that could actually be illegal?
Well, I think that's what the question is for most people paying attention right now. That's not yet clear. The reality is that we have reporters, and not quite yet like an investigation, though, but looking into the full scope of Michael Cohen's involvement professionally in terms of business and his donors and where money is coming from. And all of that isn't yet clear right now. And one thing related to that you mentioned earlier, one reason I think it's kind of difficult to keep the personal attorney separate from the investigation stuff happening to the campaign is because sometimes you have people on both sides talking about issues related to the other. I mean, I believe Giuliani was on TV earlier this week talking about the Iran nuclear deal, which has nothing to do with why he was actually hired. And you have Sarah Huckabee Sanders talking about Michael Cohen.
Right.
And so people are confused because the staff appears confused at times.
Well, and that's also, Domenico, I wonder, you know, going back to Michael Avenatti, about the potential impact of his strategy with this. I mean, the whole Stormy Daniels matter has been tried in the court of public opinion basically from the beginning. But when it gets to this point, I wonder if this reaches a point where eventually trying this matter in the court of public opinion has to pivot, because sooner or later he's going to have to try this matter in court, like court. And the public opinion stuff could work against him if it creates a prejudicial legal environment.
Yeah, I mean, he's been very skilled at being able to, you know, play Trump's game in a way that I think probably nobody else has been able to at this point. You know, you've had Republicans sort of cowed in Trump's shadow, Democrats who've, you know, hollered from the mountaintops and haven't been able to sort of puncture the armor. And yet here's Avenatti, and everything that he keeps bringing forward, for whatever reason, it's able to stick. Now, you're right, he's going to have to eventually prove a case or not prove a case, and there is the potential for jumping the shark. But right now, he's been able to kind of play Trump's game.
Let's shift gears now and talk about Gina Haspel, the deputy director of the CIA, who is President Trump's nominee to be the new director. Ms. Haspel sat through an intense 2.5-hour hearing before the Senate Intelligence Committee this week. Its former director, Mike Pompeo, is now our Secretary of State. Haspel opened her testimony by trying to get a jump on her critics.
Having served in that tumultuous time, I can offer you my personal commitment, clearly and without reservation, that under my leadership, on my watch, CIA will not restart a detention and interrogation program.
That's part of Gina Haspel's opening statement from her testimony this week. Now, that was not enough for some senators who grilled her on her role in America's so-called enhanced interrogation program. Many people consider that program tantamount to torture. Now, if you've been listening through the week, you've heard a number of perspectives about this across our conversations. But for those who have missed, yesterday we spoke to the former CIA director, Michael Hayden, retired 4-star general. He is a big supporter of Gina Haspel. And he says that her role in that program of enhanced interrogation misses the point.
That was America's program. It wasn't CIA's, and it certainly wasn't Gina Haspel's. That was ordered by our president. It was okayed by the attorney general. It was briefed to Congress, who at the time was enthusiastic and only asked, are you sure that's enough? And the director of CIA thought it would be operationally effective.
That's retired General Michael Hayden, formerly the director of the CIA. We also heard this week from former CIA operative Todd Rosenblum. He's a little more skeptical.
There's an original sin for me in Gina's decision-making, and that was her role in destroying the only videotapes that were made of the enhanced interrogation program. I think that's a real significant decision that she made that really does preclude her from gaining the trust of this confirmed position.
I wonder where all of this leaves us, Annie. We had Gina Haspel's counterargument to the concerns about torture not really answering the question squarely as to what she thought of the morality of these interrogation methods. But on the other hand, I do understand General Hayden's point. This idea that when the CIA makes an operational decision, they don't do it in a vacuum. Mm-hmm. They have to go to Congress and the White House and the Justice Department. And all four legs of this stool all said, go forth. Which side of this argument wins the day?
Well, first of all, if winning the day means is she going to be confirmed
exactly.
or not, it looks like she will be confirmed. McCain made a statement saying coming out against her, but it doesn't. And his voice obviously carries a lot of impact with his Senate colleagues when it comes to the issue of torture. But that being said, I think Collins and Manchin both said they were going to vote yes. So
Susan Collins, like, Republican from Maine, and Joe Manchin, Democrat from West Virginia.
Thank you. Yes. So it looks like she will get confirmed by a slim margin. That being said, the testimony yesterday was really about not about was she right or wrong in the past, but clarifying her position on torture today. And I think that's where she got a lot of criticism. She didn't. One exchange that I thought was powerful was Kamala Harris grilling her four times whether or not she – what was the exact question?
About whether or not it was moral, if she felt that it was moral or immoral looking back, even with
yes,
hindsight,
right.
if it was immoral what the CIA
and
did.
And she wouldn't answer yes or no. So I think that is really the question. It's not what she did back then. It's that with hindsight, would she change her position? And she didn't really clarify that. So I think that left a lot of questions and didn't really resolve the issues that are the blemish on, like everyone agrees, she's supremely qualified for the position. She's been in the CIA for 33 years. But the testimony didn't help clarify that piece of it.
I wonder maybe, Domenico, if that's kind of the larger Rorschach test of this hearing. I mean, I hear you on the questioning from Kamala Harris, the Democrat from California. It seems like, in a way, and I wonder if you see it this way, the vote on Gina Haspel will be something of a Rorschach test on how we view the CIA's role today, on how we view enhanced interrogation techniques, torture today. I understand the general's argument, and partly Gina Haspel's argument, about going where you're sent, enacting policies that the government allows you to with oversight of Congress and others. I wonder if that's really the story, is whether or not we learn something about Congress's attitude toward interrogation and torture based on whether or not they approve Gina Haspel.
Well, first of all, we should note that Congress has already changed the law. So they have to go by the Army Field Manual now. They can no longer perform these, quote, enhanced interrogation techniques or what other call torture, things like waterboarding. It outlines and outlaws specific techniques that John McCain and Dianne Feinstein, the California senator, who quarterbacked this amendment to legislation to say that that wasn't allowed to be used any longer. Haspel said that she would follow the law, that she would maintain the moral standard of following the law. Now, there is a big difference, as we were talking about with Kamala Harris's questioning of her when it comes to morality and legality. And I do think that that fine line, had she talked about it in a way where she felt that it was immoral or with hindsight, then she would have probably won over a lot more Democrats. But if you think about it from a work colleague perspective, people in the CIA felt like they were following orders and that they were doing what they needed to do to try to keep the country safe. And she wasn't going to throw her colleagues under the bus. Of course, that wasn't enough for John McCain. And I'll just read a little bit of his statement. He said, "Ms. Haspel's role in overseeing the use of torture by Americans is disturbing. Her refusal to acknowledge torture's immorality is disqualifying," he said. And then he empathized with the CIA agents. He said, "I know that those who used enhanced interrogation methods and those who approved them wanted to protect Americans from harm. I appreciate their dilemma and the strain of their duty, but as I've argued many times, the methods we employ to keep our nation safe must be as right and just as the values we aspire to live up to and promote in the world."
And that's part of a statement that Senator McCain released soon after her testimony.
Right.
There's
right.
One. The reason this is so important, also we have to remember that President Trump said during the campaign
yes.
that
yep.
torture
this
works. So
and that he would do worse than waterboarding.
Worse.
Correct. And a question here is, will Gina Haspel at the CIA be a check on that if he pressures her to, use torture? And Sarah Sanders in the briefing earlier this week when asked, does President Trump still believe that torture works, just punted and said, I haven't had that conversation with him recently.
Senator McCain came up in some of your comments. Crystal wrote on our Facebook page, discuss the outright disrespect being shown to Senator McCain by his own party and discuss how our nation fell to such lows.
Yeah, I wrote about that earlier for The Fix when McCain expressed reportedly that he had no interest in having President Trump attend his funeral. He was attacked repeatedly by some Trump loyalists for not being a respecter of conservatism or of the president. The reality is that the Republican Party has been shifting towards Trumpism for a while, and one of the people that played a significant role in moving it in this direction, quite frankly, was Sarah Palin, someone who Senator McCain picked for his presidential race, who came out early in support of Trump and got people on the Trump train who perhaps would not have. And we are seeing just people embrace a nationalism and a rejection of bipartisanship that McCain is actually known for. And some of the comments in response to him aren't just political in their critiques, but very low blow and suggest some real character issues.
And I have a couple points to make on this. If you can't pick the guest list to your funeral, what can you pick the guest list to, right? I mean, the fact is, and let's remember all these people who want to say that John McCain needs to be respectful of President Trump. I think wasn't the very first thing that President Trump or then candidate Trump got in trouble for was saying that he preferred people who weren't captured.
Who didn't get captured.
You know, I mean, what, you know, at what line do you have integrity to say that you don't that or when do you have to sort of, you know, swallow your own pride or not? I mean, this is his decision to make.
Well, and Annie, it's also worth noting that this is a line of conversation that John McCain has been on for some time. There was that speech he gave a few months ago. Oh, I forget exactly when it was, but some months ago when he returned to the Senate and gave this wide-ranging speech basically about civility and about returning to regular order and ignoring some of the voices he thought were tearing apart the political discourse. To hell with them, he said. So this is kind of the latest iteration of something that he's been sparring with the president over for some time.
I think he's staking out a position as the person speaking from a moral authority. And this is John McCain in winter and has the status to be heard on these issues. The latest wrinkle between the Trump world and McCain world was this dust up with a low-level White House staffer making a joke in a meeting that leaked, like, what do we care about McCain? He's dying anyway. Which the White House hasn't formally apologized for or said anything about, but it doesn't help.
Yeah, although I believe the White House did acknowledge the comment was made, but
didn't apologize.
Did not apologize for it. Before we leave the Gina Haspel story, let me get to a comment from Tony, who tweeted, there is nothing Haspel could have said to quote-unquote win over those opposed to her. This is all politics. Annie Carney, what do you think? Was this all politics, or was there something Gina Haspel could have done to win over her critics?
Some critics know, but, you know, the Washington Post editorial board, for instance, came out against her after the hearing. And I think they said that she didn't, you know, fail to kind of explain her current position, as I was saying earlier. So I think that for certain people who are opposed now, the hearing could have swayed it either way, depending on her comments. Of course, there's some people who are so outraged by the actual actions she took and destroying the tape that nothing she says could change their opinion. I think there's probably a mix of both.
These are evidentiary tapes about this black site in Thailand that some had asked the CIA to keep, right. And she was part of destroying the tapes.
Her hearing was interrupted by a protester yelling, "Bloody Gina." I don't think that woman was going to be swayed either way.
Exactly.
But other more sober people watching, like the Washington Post editorial board, maybe could have been
human
swayed.
Rights is a real issue for a lot of people, a lot of voters.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah,
for sure. And I will say, and I'm not asking you to speak for the Post editorial board, Eugene, mm-hmm. but I get the feeling that Gina Haspel was one of the less purely political Trump appointees of the ones that have come up so far. I mean, she is a CIA lifer. She knows the agency. Mm-hmm. As Annie said, the general agreement is that she was thoroughly qualified. There were these ethical questions that came up. But on both sides of the aisle, it seemed at least that people recognized she had
the raw credentials to do the job.
And I think that was kind of the point that Tom Cotton was trying to make, that Haspel was someone who had been respected by people outside of Trump world before Trump got in the White House, to the degree that had her name been mentioned before now, that perhaps she would have had an easier time getting moving forward. But I think, yeah, she generally is well respected. But I think the issue of regarding how she feels about waterboarding serving under a president who is supportive of it was a real issue for people on the left.
It's interesting that the problem with Trump nominees so often is that these people in any other administration would not be qualified for the jobs that they are being put up for now. And that just the lack of experience. And here's someone who's more qualified than probably any other Trump nominee. And yet she has this other big moral issue that goes with it.
Mike writes, Trump's approval ratings are inching up with all of the media's negativity. Just think what they would be if he got the same treatment as Obama. Steve emailed, Donald Trump and Mike Pence were received by cheering crowds in my hometown of Elkhart, Indiana, which was an economic basket case in 2008 and is now booming thanks to President Obama's stimulus. But as my fellow Hoosiers adored their president, oil prices were spiking because of Trump's withdrawal from the Iran deal. China was buying soybeans from Brazil instead of Indiana, and his steel and aluminum tariffs threatened our RV industry. Interesting perspective from Steve, I think, particularly, I mean, clearly not a fan of the president, but more to the point, particularly as we get into midterm election season, the primary election season that's finally kicked off. I wonder how many more Steves there are in states, particularly those that went for Donald Trump.
Well, you do have to wonder, somewhere President Obama's got to be shaking his head, because Elkhart was like a signature thing for him. I mean, how many times he went to Elkhart, how many times he held it up as something that needed to be helped and turned around. And then you look at the photos from last night's event before Trump's rally. People treating Trump like he's their comic book hero.
Tell us more about the event.
So Trump last night, was in Elkhart, Indiana, and decided to hold a sort of campaign rally. And it's important that to realize that Indiana has one of the big Senate elections this fall that are coming up with Joe Donnelly, who's a vulnerable Democratic senator. And remember, Democrats need to net two seats in the House to be able to take back – I mean, sorry, in the Senate, to be able to take back the Senate. Donnelly's race is one that Republicans are targeting. This is a really bad year structurally for Democrats when it comes to the Senate. There are 10 states where Democrats are defending that Trump won in those places, and in some of those places by a lot, like in Indiana by almost 20 points. So huge primary there this past Tuesday, where you had two Republican congressmen squaring off against a businessman conservative outsider. Heard that one before? Mm-hmm. Guess who won? It wasn't the shoeshine, slick-dressing Republican congressman. They did not get a promotion. It was the businessman outsider, Mike Braun, who runs a warehousing and shipping company. And he ran a brutal ad showing Congressman Rakita and Messer, Luke Messer, as cardboard cutouts of each other in red ties, blue suits. And when he brought them around to people, they said things to him like, boy, this is how people in the swamp dress. So what you're starting to see here is a changing of the two parties, and it's not complete. When people wonder, how can President Trump's base still support him when they haven't seen the kinds of gains, or you haven't seen the legislative accomplishments that he had promised? Well, they're looking at it as it's these guys. It's guys like Rokita and Messer who are in their, blue suits and red ties, who are holding back the president's agenda. And we need people who are strictly going to be with Trump.
Well, yes, I hear you in that, in terms of they may not, they may dislike the alternative in a way, the alternative of politics as usual in Washington. Although, Eugene, in West Virginia, one of those alternative choices, Don Blankenship, did not do so well in the race. He turned a lot of heads for both his desire to get into the campaign and also for some of the ads that he ran. Here is one ad that Mr. Blankenship took out in the days leading up to the election, targeting Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell.
Swamp Captain Mitch McConnell has created millions of jobs for China people. While doing so, Mitch has gotten rich. In fact, his China family has given him tens of millions of dollars. Mitch's swamp people are now running false negative ads against me. They are also childishly calling me despicable and mentally ill. The war to drain the swamp and create jobs for West Virginia people has begun. I will beat Joe Manchin and ditch Cocaine Mitch for the sake of the kids.
That was a campaign ad from Don Blankenship. Blankenship's campaign did not succeed, by the way. He did not win the West Virginia primary. But, Eugene, China people, his China family, it's a reference to Mitch McConnell's wife, Elaine Chao, who's Chinese-American.
Right. Yeah, indeed. I mean, he used some of the very racially insensitive or just flat-out racist language that we heard coming from Roy Moore, that we've heard coming from some other far-right members of the Republican Party seeking office, who actually had support from many people who were on the Trump train. But Trump and Trump Jr. came out very vocally saying, do not vote for Blankenship. They never said don't vote for him because of character issues and because this is not what we think of America. They said don't vote for him because he can't win. And I think it's really worth mentioning that there's no proof that Blankenship lost because West Virginia said this is not the type of person who reflects our values. There was significant disapproval of Blankenship because of his business ethics and his past involvement with minors, and there was prison time and deaths. And so there was quite a bit that kept them from backing him. I think it could be really too early to see if people who are truly Trumpier than Trump, as Blankenship described himself, won't have success in future midterms.
Yeah, Don Blankenship got about 20% of the vote. He was defeated by Patrick Morrissey, who got about 35% of that vote. I wonder, though, Domenico, what about on the Democratic side? We talked a lot about the Republican side of this race, understandably, and we didn't get much conversation about the Democratic side. We've heard talk about a blue wave in November, plenty of surfer metaphors on air and online, I guess requisite surfer metaphors. Did we learn anything this Tuesday about whether that blue wave is coming, what that might look like? I mean, do the Joe Manchins of the world face challenges from people who are more blue than him? What is this shaping up to be?
You know, it's a two-sided coin, obviously, because Tuesday night showed us a few things. One, you had a Democratic primary in the governor's race in Ohio with Dennis Kucinich, the former congressman, going up against Richard Cordray, who was the former head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau appointed by President Obama. There was a lot of attention on this race because Kucinich tried to paint Cordray as more of a centrist Democrat and somebody who was less progressive on guns than he was. And Cordray trounced him. He beat him by 40 points. So if you were looking for a sort of progressive wave, that didn't happen at that point. Maybe Democrats are a little bit more progressive, or maybe we don't read too much into it because there are several races coming up over the next month. You know, there are about 130 congressional races between now and June 5th that'll be settled for the general election. But you're going to have places like in California, whether or not Democrats can get through, if progressives wind up tanking some of those candidates. Does the state senator in California give Dianne Feinstein a strong challenge? Right now, her team is pretty confident that they won't. So at this point, you have a couple countervailing forces. One, that President Trump's approval rating is still historically low, and that is the biggest indicator of whether or not waves usually take place. At the same time, the economy is doing very well. 3.9% unemployment is the lowest since 2000. Like we mentioned earlier about North Korea, we've moved away from a nuclear standoff to a point where there's more hopes for unification with North Korea. So, you know, how those forces wind up canceling each other out or what winds up happening there, you know, midterms are about activism, and right now there's a lot of energy on the Democratic side.
I was going to say, in addition to that, speaking of waves and activism, another wave to keep your eye on is the pink wave. And so we saw the overwhelming majority of women who ran on Tuesday in primaries actually win their seats. The challenge, though, is many of the women who won the Democratic primary are running in districts that they're not expected to beat the Republican incumbent, especially in places like North Carolina and Indiana. And so the activism will determine whether or not we'll see the turnout needed to be victorious.
I'll quote my colleague Mara Liasson, who said, look, you got to have surfboards in the water to be able to catch the wave.
I hear that. Far be it from me to argue with Mara Liasson. One more voice from Indiana before we move on. Greg in Indianapolis emailed, regarding the Indiana primary, please note that most counties had voter turnout in the teens. This primary may not reflect what may happen in my state in November. Let's move on from politics to a lot of the news affecting the Me Too movement this week. A number of allegations have surfaced against men in politics, media, literature, Hollywood, news, music, and more. Four women alleged that former New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman physically abused them. The New Yorker published their allegations Monday. We say former Attorney General because although Schneiderman denied the allegations, he resigned hours after the story was published. Now, the thing is that Eric Schneiderman's been very vocal about the Me Too movement. He praised it in a recent episode of Alec Baldwin's podcast called Here's the Thing.
We have an investigation into the Weinstein companies and are involved with a variety of matters related to that. So can't touch on that. I mean, look, the movement is extraordinary. I think it's changing the conversation. It is a part of what I see as this moment of social transformation and of the emergence of a new political movement, but it's, you know, that's a whole other podcast.
That was Eric Schneiderman speaking on Alec Baldwin's podcast called Here's the Thing. Schneiderman sued Harvey Weinstein and was very vocal at the time in condemning the Hollywood mogul's actions.
We have investigated other companies for patterns of sexual discrimination or harassment. We have never seen anything as despicable as what we've seen here. As set forth in our petition, the conduct really was shocking. There's a lot of language used there that I'm not going to use, but some of the citations to things that Mr. Weinstein said to employees, the pattern of abuse, the use of employees to manipulate his targets or victims of sexual harassment is just really astonishing. The fact that he had a group of employees who were responsible for cleaning up his office after sexual encounters, including returning articles of clothing to the women who left them behind, is really something that should be shocking to anyone. And it is clear that this was done in violation of the law.
Part of what Eric Schneiderman said at the time as his office was suing Harvey Weinstein. That was just one of the developments with regard to powerful men and sexual harassment accusations. Also, the organization behind the Oscars expelled Bill Cosby and Roman Polanski from its membership. Polanski wants to appeal the decision, but according to The Hollywood Reporter, he is threatening to sue if he is not allowed to appeal through the Academy. Also, NBC News completed its investigation of the event surrounding Matt Lauer being fired from The Today Show. The report was not conducted by an outside contractor. It concluded that there is, quote, no evidence indicating that any NBC News or Today Show leadership, news HR, or others in positions of authority in the news division received any complaints about Lauer's workplace behavior prior to November 27, 2017, prior to the date in which all of this came to a head. Annie, it's kind of incredible the way that this has all moved, not just from accusations or from people losing their jobs, but now investigations and policies possibly changing and honors being revoked. This has kind of gone to another level.
It is. And the Eric Schneiderman story was one of the more shocking ones on the continuum of the transgressions. And those women said in the story they were motivated. I mean, it really is an avalanche. They were motivated by Schneiderman trying to be the white knight and making all these pro-Me Too statements. And they just thought, this hypocrisy can't go on. So they came out literally because of him positioning himself as a leader of the Me Too movement.
Before we go, as promised, we head to Hawaii and Alaska for two last stories. We are watching the news out of Hawaii with the Kilauea volcano. Its eruption has already forced thousands of people to evacuate. More than a dozen fissures have appeared on the island, leaking lava and gas. Geologists warn that an explosive eruption could come in the weeks to come. Meanwhile, the sulfur dioxide that's been released is posing some danger to residents where it might spread. More coverage of that online at npr.org. And in Alaska, PBS has announced a new kids show called Molly of Denali, the first nationally distributed kids show to star an Alaska native. The show is aimed at kids from ages 4 to 8. It'll follow 10-year-old Molly Mabray as she goes on adventures with her friends and her dog. There's always a trusty dog. And it will feature Alaskan native actors and writers and languages. Molly of Denali debuts next year. Annie Carney, White House reporter for Politico. Annie, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro. Thanks, Domenico.
You're welcome.
And Eugene Scott, political reporter for The Washington Post. Eugene, enjoy your weekend.
Thanks for having me.
We'll dive into the international section of the Friday News Roundup in just a moment.
This is America. Don't catch you slipping now. Don't catch you slipping now.
with what I'm whipping up.
Support for NPR and the following message come from the NPR Wine Club. Discover hand-selected wines from award-winning vineyards around the world. Learn the stories behind each one and enjoy unique bottles inspired by your favorite NPR shows, like Weekend Edition, all with the convenience of home delivery. A special welcome offer includes a bottle of Weekend Edition Cabernet Sauvignon. If you're 21 years or older, join in the fun at nprwineclub.org/1A.
Planet Money tip number 17. Sometimes life is exactly like the movies.
T-minus 30 seconds.
They said T-minus. They said T-minus.
Planet Money, a podcast about the economy and sometimes about rocket ships.
Before we get back to the roundup, Sunday is Mother's Day, of course, but once the celebration ends, a lot of moms face challenges that cards and candy cannot solve. Parenting can cost women in the workplace wages and opportunities. Here in the U.S., we tend to focus more on the baby than the mom once the child is born. It leaves a lot of women feeling kind of aimless in their postpartum lives, and maternal mortality rates are the highest in America compared to developed nations like Canada or the U.K. Some recent reporting on this crisis by NPR and ProPublica earned a Pulitzer nomination this year.
And so Alex Hicks begins the story. Marlene was days away from delivering a baby boy upstairs that night, snuggling in bed with the girls.
And I just hear two or three just loud thump, you know, rolling down, boom, boom, boom. And I literally race upstairs, and Marlene is laying on the floor unconscious. And I just get under her, and she's, you know, kind of hissing, and I was holding her, and I remember her teeth started clenching, and everything happened so fast, yet so slow. And you watch like the paramedics doing a CPR on your wife, who's 9 months pregnant. It's like the worst thing in the world.
Part of the reporting by NPR's Renee Montaigne and ProPublica, which was nominated for a Pulitzer this year. That's where we'll start our conversation next week about modern motherhood. Why are so many American women at risk when they become pregnant and go into labor? That discussion will kick off our series called Beyond Mother's Day. If you're a mom, what do you wish more people understood about motherhood? Or if you are considering motherhood, what would you like some advice on? Leave us a voicemail, 855-236-1A1A. Foreign policy dominated the news coming out of the White House this week. President Trump withdrew the United States from the Iran nuclear deal, one of his predecessor's signature foreign policy achievements. The newly confirmed Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, returned from North Korea with three Americans who had been imprisoned there. And the White House announced a summit between Trump and North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un, which will be held next month in Singapore. Many major challenges lie ahead, especially the conflict between Israel and Iran. That escalated sharply after Israeli airstrikes on Iranian targets in Syria. We'll talk about those stories and more, including the election of the world's oldest national leader and why China banned Peppa Pig from social media. Who knew a children's cartoon character could be a threat to national security? Joining us to discuss it on today's Friday News Roundup is Mark Landler, White House correspondent for The New York Times, covering U.S. foreign policy. He is the author of Alter Egos, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and the Twilight Struggle Over American Power. Mark, welcome back to the Roundup.
Great to be here, Joshua.
Also glad to welcome back Nadia Bilbasi, Washington Bureau Chief for Al Arabiya. Nadia, welcome back to 1A.
Thank you for having me.
And Natan Gutman, Washington correspondent for Israeli Public TV. Natan, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Let's begin with Israel, carrying out a powerful series of airstrikes against Iranian military sites in Syria. It was the largest attack in Syria from Israel in decades. This was in response to their claim that Iran attacked Israeli military positions in the Golan Heights. Natan Gutman, this seems to have escalated really quickly, so let's pull back a little bit. What happened to touch all this fighting off?
Well, I think there's, for the past couple of years already, we're seeing this tit-for-tat between Israel and Iran over the control of Syria and over the question of how much leverage will the Iranians have in Syria and how much of a threat that is to neighboring Israel. And for a while, it was more of a proxy war with Iranians supporting certain forces there and Israelis doing their own part to try to limit them. And then we saw a few very limited Israeli airstrikes. But that, in the last couple of months, as things escalated and Israelis point out the Iranians sending a UAV into an unarmed airplane, into unmanned airplane, into Israeli territory.
A drone, basically.
A drone, right.
Right.
And Israel retaliated with its own airstrike. And from there, things started moving much faster until what we saw here, which was the first rocket attack by Iranians, an organized rocket attack against Israeli posts in the Golan Heights, which triggered what seems to be a response that Israel had prepared for months in advance, which was basically there is this excuse now to try to take out as many Iranian forces and missile and rocket launchers in Syrian territory.
Nadia Bilbasi, Hunter kind of gets at the core of what some of our listeners are asking regarding how this started. Hunter asked on our Facebook page, who attacked first, Iran or Israel? My understanding is that Israel has been bombing Syrian and Iranian forces in Syria for years now. This week, Iran finally retaliated. Is that the case?
That's more or less the case, because the Israelis, as the person who asked the question said, they have been attacking Hezbollah and Iranian positions in Syria for a while. But the last one, actually, they have killed few Iranians, and the Iranians did not respond. And it seems that the withdrawal from the nuclear agreement by President Trump has triggered this. So the Iranians decided to launch 20 missiles into what they call the buffer zone, which is in the Golan Heights that Israel annexed in 1981, and is considered occupied territories that Israel captured in 1967 war. But the interesting thing about this was we were watching the news on Thursday night, and everybody thought that that's it, is going to be a full-scale war. And the next morning, everything was back to normal. The schools were open, life was normal in the Golan, same on the Syrian side. And it seems that it's very strategic attacks between both. It was very restrained and very strategic in terms of attacking only military targets. The Iranians didn't go for the settlements in the Golan Heights. They didn't go for the civilians. They went for Israeli military and vice versa. The Israelis thought it's a chance for them now to take off completely, to take out all the command and center for the Iranians, to take the intelligence post, to take a weapon depot, etc. And they said they actually neutralized most of the Iranian threat. Israel will never allow the Iranians to have a position just like Hezbollah did in Syria and to threaten them. And for them, it was a matter of time. But the interesting point, again, it wasn't that the United States, as many people thought, that the withdrawal from the agreement has emboldened Israel and allowed them to attack the Iranians once and for all and take them out, but actually the Russians. It was a meeting between President Putin and Netanyahu almost a few hours before. It lasted for many, many hours. And the Russians promised the Israelis that they're not going to supply the Syrian regimes with S-300 rockets, basically, that will advance the Syrian military. So from that point of view, it was the Russians who called the shot. They were the masters. So it seems if the Americans want to attack Syrian chemical weapons, they coordinate with the Russians. If the Israelis want to attack Hezbollah or the Iranians, they will coordinate with the Russians.
Since you brought up the Iran nuclear deal, we should talk about that. And I'm glad that you kind of explain how the targeted nature of these attacks, but these do come less than 2 days after the U.S. did leave the Iran nuclear deal. President Trump chose to exit what's technically known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA. Here is how the president characterized the need to pull out.
At the heart of the Iran deal was a giant fiction that a murderous regime desired only a peaceful nuclear energy program. Today, we have definitive proof that this Iranian promise was a lie. Last week, Israel published intelligence documents, long concealed by Iran, conclusively showing the Iranian regime and its history of pursuing nuclear weapons. The fact is, this was a horrible, one-sided deal that should have never, ever been made. It didn't bring calm. It didn't bring peace, and it never will.
part of President Trump's statement this week explaining why he's pulled the United States out of the Iran nuclear deal. Breyer emailed, "It's been obvious since the signing of the Iran deal that Israel had been trying to get the U.S. to fight against Iran on their behalf, and the nuclear deal thwarted that. Now that we've torn it up, we will be back to the brink of war constantly, with Israeli provocations trying to draw us into their fight. Horrible outcome from a myopic President Trump." Mark Landler, could you respond to that, particularly pulling apart this idea of ending up in a shooting war and the actual intent of the Iran nuclear deal? Part of the debate about the deal this week has been about understanding what the deal was actually designed to do, what it was actually capable to do, and not blaming the deal for things that it wasn't designed to do, that weren't in its scope.
Well, I mean, first of all, to react to what your listener said, I think he actually has a point. I think the Israelis have been fairly open, or at least the Prime Minister of Israel, many in the Israeli security establishment take a different view, that they wanted this deal ripped up. And when you rip up the deal and you don't have a plan B, it's hard to see where you go aside from a higher risk of military confrontation. But to talk about the deal itself, it's important to remind people what this deal was supposed to do and what it was not supposed to do. It was a narrowly focused nuclear disarmament deal. It did not address Iran's ballistic missile program in any substantial way, and it did not address Iran's behavior in the region at all. And I think one of the things that happened in the aftermath of the deal that perhaps surprised the Obama administration, or at least disappointed the Obama administration, is that the Iranians actually became more provocative and more belligerent. Hardliners inside Iran began flexing their muscles. And so rather than seeing the deal as the first stage toward pacifying Iran, toward bringing Iran more into the community of nations, it actually had in the short run an opposite effect. Iran became more problematic, more aggressive. It began backing militias more aggressively in Iraq, in Syria, in Lebanon, the Houthi rebels in Yemen. And so the critics of the deal had a valid point. Iran is more of a malign actor in the region, perhaps, than it has been. Now, is that a reason to rip up the deal? A lot of people say no, of course not, because one thing the deal did do is it did impose some restriction on Iranian behavior. And I don't think it is coincidental that we saw this surge in violence 2 days after the deal was ripped up. I don't think that's a coincidence or an accident. I think to some extent, ripping up the deal removes the cuffs from both the Israelis, the Saudis, and the Iranians.
Natan, what would you say to Breyer's comment that Israel had been trying to get the U.S. to fight Iran on Israel's behalf, and now that the deal's been torn up, that the door is open for that?
I don't think that Israel's goal is to get the United States involved in a military conflict with Iran. However, clearly, Israel didn't like the deal from the get-go and did everything that it could to convince the American people, the American administration, and whoever was willing to listen, that it's time to rip up the agreement. For Israelis, or for the Israeli government, I should say, the best plan B is not a military confrontation between the United States and Iran, but rather severe pressure that would force Iran into accepting better deals.
Yesterday, we spoke to Michael Hayden, retired four-star general, former director of the CIA, and we asked him for his thoughts about President Trump pulling out of the Iran nuclear agreement. Here is part of what General Hayden said.
So with regard to the narrow question of Iran nuclear now, all right, we left a zone of stability to a zone of instability, and I don't know where it goes. But more importantly for me, the view of the American intelligence community, I'm not talking about the bubbas who are retired. I'm talking about the guys inside and what it is they say and allow themselves to say publicly. 3 points. One, Iran is not a material breach of the agreement. They're abiding by the agreement. Two, with the agreement, Iran is further away from a weapon than they would be without the agreement. Three, with the agreement, we know more about the Iranian program than we would know if we did not have the agreement. And despite those three hard facts from the truth tellers trying to inform the formation of American policy, we just walked away from the deal yesterday.
That was retired General Michael Hayden, former director of the CIA. Meanwhile, the other parties to the Iran nuclear deal have reacted, saying they plan to stay in the deal. Here is part of the statement from the European Union.
The nuclear deal with Iran is crucial for the security of the region, of Europe, and of the entire world. As long as Iran continues to implement its nuclear-related commitments, as it is doing so far, the European Union will remain committed to the continued full and effective implementation of the nuclear deal. We fully trust the work, the competence, and the autonomy of the International Atomic Energy Agency that has published 10 reports certifying that Iran has fully complied with its commitments.
That's part of the statement from the European Union. So, Nadia Bilbasi, we heard the view from General Hayden, forgetting about what the retired bubbas have to say, but the people who are inside, and then the view from Europe saying that the deal is, in the words of the statement, crucial. Where does this go from here? How do you see it?
Well, initially the deal was signed by what they call the 5+1, which is the 5 permanent members of the Security Council plus Germany. President Rouhani, immediately after President Trump declared the withdrawal, he said, now we have 4+1. So we're sticking to the deal. We're going to talk to our European allies, according to President Rouhani. And if this is in the interest of Iran, we will continue with the deal. Now, the Europeans, as you noticed, they lobbied hard Washington. We saw President Macron come in talking to President Trump. We saw Angela Merkel, and we saw Boris Johnson, the foreign minister of the UK. Three of them came, and they said to President Trump, let's work around this. But he was adamant. For many reasons. Number one, he wants to fulfill a campaign promise. As you know, this president stick to his promises. And number two, he saw serious flaws with the agreement. It's not just that the ballistic missiles were not addressed and Iran nefarious activities that lead into great instability in the Middle East, in Yemen, in Lebanon, in Iraq, and in Syria. But also he said the sunset clause. What does that mean? That after 10 years or 15 years maximum, this deal will expire. And therefore, Iran has the know-how to develop a nuclear weapon. So the president said, no matter what, shouldn't be time limited. We should renegotiate this deal. And second, the inspectors. We cannot just give an advance notice to Tehran and say, by the way, we're showing up today. You should open all the sites, including the military sites. And this is the 2 points the United States want to address. So 2 days ago, I think we have a briefing with senior officials, and they were saying, look, we withdraw from the deal, but we're willing to sign a new deal. And the new deal has to address all the points that we raise. And we believe that if the choice between for the Europeans between us and Tehran, initially they will come back and support the United States position.
Well, regardless of whether or not a new deal is signed and whether some of these legacy issues can be dealt with, the prospect of sanctions, Mark, now continues to hang over the heads of all the parties here. Germany's ambassador, Richard Grenell, the new U.S. ambassador to Germany, I should say, sent a tweet this week that reads, quote, as at real Donald Trump said, U.S. sanctions will target critical sectors of Iran's economy. German companies doing business in Iran should wind down operations immediately, unquote. That tweet got him a bit of a rebuke by a former ambassador to Britain and the U.S. Clearly, Mark, there's some anxiety about the potential economic impacts of what's happened to the deal.
Well, look, the Europeans have said they're going to stay in the deal, but everyone here is very realistic. If the United States puts on sanctions on energy and on the Iranian Central Bank as a practical matter, no European company that does any business with the American financial system can be active in Iran without getting into a major problem with the United States. So the Europeans took a strong line this week saying we'll stay in the deal. But privately, they all tell you that whether it's Total, the French oil company, or German technology companies that sell equipment in Iran, they're going to pull out of Iran. Iran is going to lose whatever benefit it picked up from the lifting of these sanctions. So as a practical matter, the American president has the ability to effectively vitiate this agreement. And that's what President Trump did this week. On the sanctions and on the prospect for renewed negotiation, that's a trickier issue because there the United States won't have the Europeans backing them up. They won't have the Russians and the Chinese backing them up. They're also signatories to the deal. They won't have credibility at the United Nations Security Council. So this idea that the White House put out there that we'll just embark on a new round of negotiations and get better terms, good luck to them. They're not going to have the support to do that. And I think one of the things that to me looked like blindness on the White House's part is the fact that it took 6 or 8 years of concerted diplomacy to get the sanctions that brought Iran to the table in the first place. Does President Trump have the stomach and the patience to do that? I'm deeply doubtful.
And the political will to do
that. And the political will.
Before we move on from this, Natan, I wonder what this might mean for other nuclear programs. We heard Saudi Arabia's foreign minister tell CNN that if Iran ramps up its program, we can expect Saudi Arabia to move on bolstering its program, which brings up all kind of other issues with proxy wars and larger pan-Arab concerns. Is this like the first domino of a larger relay?
Well, I guess it depends if we think that the Saudis are bluffing or not on that. Are they really thinking of starting their own nuclear program? Will this ignite a nuclear arms race in the Middle East? Or is this just a way of pressuring the United States and the international community, saying, well, you better take care of Iran or else everyone else is going to have nukes in the region? It could also impact the other big nuclear question, which is North Korea, of course. How does Donald Trump enter nuclear negotiations with North Korea when he set the bar so high for Iran? Does this mean that when he meets with Kim Jong-un, the starting point will be no enrichment, no ballistic missiles, no threatening your neighbors? That could be a non-starter for that meeting.
Since you brought up North Korea, let's shift gears and talk about North Korea now. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo arrived at a Maryland Air Base early yesterday morning at Joint Base Andrews with three Americans who were newly released from a North Korean prison. President Trump and Melania Trump met the plane early in the morning and praised North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un. Nadia Bilbasi, can you remind us how we got to this point, why the three were imprisoned and how they were let go?
Well, basically, I think the last three Americans who were there, American Koreans who were there, one of them who was in prison for almost 3 years since 2015, and the other ones were there for less than a year. Relatively, they said they were treated well, although they did some labor work there, but apparently if they're sick, they get treatment, etc. Unlike the previous Americans who were, of course, the North Koreans released him, but unfortunately he died when he came here.
You're talking about the young man, Otto Warmbier.
Exactly. Yeah. So basically, that was a big victory for the administration, that and also it shows a goodwill on the part of the North Koreans that they want to build this, what they call the confidence building measures, that they're preparing for the summit, and that's one of the conditions. And while the president was talking about withdrawing from the Iran deal, he actually linked it, as Nathan just said. He said, while I'm talking to you now, my Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, is on his way to Pyongyang now. And we didn't know whether he's going to come with the hostages or not, but the president made a big deal out of it that he went to the Andrews Air Force Base and he received them with the First Lady, with the Vice President, and he greeted them, and they were, of course, they were extremely happy to be released here. But we will see. I mean, he said this is a great thing, and he praised what everybody considered a dictator, and he called him an honorable man, and maybe this is a good thing to start the negotiation. It's sitting for the summit to have a good, positive atmosphere before they start the real negotiation.
Yeah, Mark, I was just going to ask you to get into a little of the context of all this goodwill that's been built. I mean, the White House announced just yesterday that this summit between President Trump and Kim Jong-un will take place in Singapore on June 12th. It's an interesting shift. We've kind of come a long way from the days of Little Rocket Man, Better Watch Out, to now where we're releasing hostages and getting ready to have talks with North Korea. We've come kind of a long way in a short period of time.
It's actually extraordinary. I mean, when you consider that we were threatening the North Koreans with fire and fury just a few months ago, the tone the president has taken has been remarkable. And, you know, there's two ways to look at this. The cynical way to look at it is he's naive. Kim Jong-un is going to take advantage of him. He's giving Kim Jong-un enormous credit for returning Americans that North Korea itself kidnapped. And so that we need a good dose of skepticism heading into this meeting. The optimist case is President Trump is the kind of leader who disrupts old ideas and conventional wisdom, and he's thrown the cards up in the air and bet that he can have this personal encounter with Kim Jong-un that will change the course of history. And I think it's important probably to keep an open mind to the unexpected outcome here, even as we remember all the reasons to be skeptical. And those reasons include the fact that we've been down this road with the North Koreans, not once, but twice. We did it under the Bush administration. We did it under the Bill Clinton administration. We've had denuclearization talks. They have inevitably ended badly with the North Koreans reneging on their promises and not allowing inspectors into the country. So there's a lot of cause to be careful and leery. On the other hand, President Trump has moved this very fast by being willing to break the rules and flouting convention. And so it'll be fascinating to watch whether he can actually go to this meeting and extract something unexpected. I think it's possible that he will.
Glad to get some of your thoughts on this. And by the way, Fire and Fury was 9 months ago. That was in August. Wow. It's May now. Yeah, exactly. That's kind of how quickly things have changed. Ed wrote on our website, the1a.org, Kim Jong-un was going to agree to a summit with whoever happened to be in the White House at the time his nuclear program reached a certain stage of development. It's unfortunate that Trump is getting the credit. Stroyant wrote on our website, if the Korean Peninsula is to be completely denuclearized, that means withdrawal of all U.S. troops, because the U.S. never says where its nukes are and thus never says that a particular base has no nukes. China, North Korea, and Russia would all love to see that happen. Natan, what about that? Clearly, the nuclear arsenal of North Korea is at the top of the list of things to deal with. I don't know if we have any more clarity as to what the details of that may be between the U.S. and North Korea. U.S. and South Korea, it's gotten a little bit clearer from that summit, but I don't know if the U.S.-North Korea question on nukes is any clearer now.
No, it's not, and there are many questions about it. What do we mean by denuclearization? What do we mean about disarmament? And, of course, when you go beyond the nuclear question, North Korea has a huge conventional arsenal threatening its neighbors. What do you do about that and about the U.S. conventional presence in South Korea? So these are many questions that need to be dealt with. The bigger one is, what would be Kim's motivation to give up his nuclear weapons? What could he get in return? Because many think that if there's one thing that's keeping him in power, it's the fact that he's untouchable and invincible because he has nuclear weapons. Will he give that up? That's his only card right now. But just to pick up on what Mark was saying, Donald Trump isn't the only disruptive leader in this game. So Kim Jong-un seems to be just as disruptive. So we should be prepared for surprises.
And it is worth noting, Nadia, that we don't know exactly the condition of North Korea's nuclear program. We do know the condition of its ballistic missiles program. We know from a previous test that North Korea has fired a test with enough ballistic power to reach Washington, to reach the east coast of the U.S.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing about the nuclear issues is because there is no intelligence and it's unknown, basically. So we don't know the size, how developed it is. It's just like we have to go by his word. But what's interesting as well, it is Kim Jong-un himself, although he comes from a dynasty. And Mark just said that this negotiation went on through Clinton and Bush and six-party talks, etc. But it was through the Kim Jong-sung and the grandfather and the father. This guy is a kid. I mean, we don't know his age. He's like 27 or 28, maximum 30. He studied and was educated in Switzerland. He might come with the different ideas. Who knows? I mean, he's going to meet with a 70-year-old man representing the superpower. They're going to sit down. They're going to talk. The only thing that unknown to us is, how does he think? What he wants in the end? So it could work both ways. Now, if he puts certain demands, like I want the U.S. to draw 26,000 troops from South Korea, that would be a non-starter. But it will be interesting. They said the summit is going to go on for a day. It might go even longer than that. It depends on the negotiation. And it was very interesting to choose Singapore itself as well, which is like the Switzerland of Asia. it's a neutral area. And also he can't travel very far. So the president is going all the way to meet him there. So it will be, all of us will be really anticipating what's going to happen on June 12th.
Before we move on from North Korea, the very nature that of him meeting with the president is on the mind of Brian in Bartlett, New Hampshire. Brian emailed, Trump is trumpeting that President Obama paid millions of dollars to get hostages released, but he did it for nothing. I beg to differ. But he, meaning the President Trump did it for nothing. I beg to differ. Trump paid through our teeth by giving Kim a summit with the President of the United States. I'd say Obama made the better deal. Mark, before we move on, what about just the value of Kim Jong-un being able to meet with the president, be photographed with the president, and not have to travel as far as the president will travel for this meeting.
It's an enormous coup for Kim Jong-un. I think the listener's exactly right. I think that this is a sort of a nonsense argument that somehow the Obama people paid more. The truth of the matter is the Obama administration got Americans out of North Korea without granting North Korea much of anything. No diplomatic breakthrough, no high-level meeting, secret trips by the head of the DNI, James Clapper, who went to get the last set of Americans out. That's a very different story than allowing Kim to stand on the world stage next to the American president. This is an unqualified triumph for Kim Jong-un, and he couldn't have hoped for a better outcome.
Much more for us to talk about as we continue the Friday News Roundup. Still to come, there was a major government change in the politics of Malaysia this week. We'll get into that, as well as a number of stories related to freedom of expression around the world. The Turkish have said enough to President Erdogan on social media. And I don't know if you've noticed, the last few weeks we've always ended the global Friday News Roundup with a story about Sweden. We're 3 for 3 this week. Stay close.
Support for 1A and the following message come from American Express. These days, keeping up with everything in the news is hard, whether it's politics or pop culture. American Express believes it's always easier to stay ahead when there's someone behind you. Easier to focus on what matters, to follow what interests you, to explore, to discover. And with American Express, you don't have to go it alone because they have your back. Don't live life without it.
What does it take to start something from nothing? And what does it take to actually build it? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on How I Built This, I speak with founders behind some of the most inspiring companies in the world. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's head to Malaysia, where there was a big change in politics this week. An opposition coalition there, led by a 92-year-old, won an election in a country that's been governed by another coalition for decades. Nadia Bill Basie, give us the backstory on this.
Well, the governing party led by President Najib Razak has been in power for a long, long time, almost 6 decades. And the opposition coalesced around a familiar figure, which is Mahathir Mohamad, who actually exited power in 1978. He was very popular to a certain extent because he managed to change Malaysia, which is a Muslim-dominated country, into a modern country. Yet he created a centralized system that benefited this person, which is the current president, which is Najib Razak. And it reminds me very much of these dynasties in Asia, whether it's Benazir Bhutto in Pakistan at the time, Nawaz Sharif. It's the same faces, or in Bangladesh or in Sri Lanka. And they keep it changing all the time because, for a short period, and they come back again. So basically, the opposition were hanging into this. He's going to be, guess what, 93 in July even. And it's to show how desperate they were, because they were fed up with President Razak. He was seen as very corrupt. And actually, I was reading some reports that was staggering. You can't even believe the amount of wealth that he amassed and has been accused of. Just at one stage, he bought his wife a diamond necklace for $23 million. He bought a Picasso painting, and don't know if he gave it to Leonardo DiCaprio, because apparently $3 million, because apparently they invested in the movie industries, including The Wolf of Wall Street. It's a bit bizarre. I don't know if it's...
That is a very Wolf of Wall Street thing to do.
Absolutely. So basically, and the Treasury Department is investigating this money laundering even in the United States. So you can see that people in Malaysia were completely fed up with that, and they went back to Mahathir Mohamad and said, come and save us, basically. So he was sworn in yesterday by the king. And I don't know he might have a great reputation, but, at 93-year-old, well, the whole trend elected, he will be the oldest elected official in the world at 92 or 93 of leading a country like Malaysia, with all the complexity of the ethnicity and the economy, etc. So now we're looking into a new era where Mahathir said, look, we're not looking for revenge, but looking for accountability. But this guy might be even put on trial.
Mark Landler, I'm glad that Nadia brought up the Treasury Department. I was just going to ask you to clarify for folks here in the U.S. who don't pay a ton of attention to Malaysia, why Malaysia matters to us, or should matter to us here in the U.S.
Well, Malaysia is commonly thought of as a sort of a moderate Muslim country. They've been allied with us in various campaigns, and I think in Afghanistan and other places. They're not an enormous country, but they are seen as a sort of a swing state in the Muslim world. It's a complex country that has an Indian and ethnic Chinese population as well. And one of the things that's fascinating about the Mahathir story, and I actually covered Mahathir almost 20 years ago as a correspondent in Asia when he was the prime minister, the added layer of intrigue here is that he has said he is going to win a pardon for his longtime protege, Anwar Ibrahim, who's been serving a lengthy jail term on a sodomy charge, a charge, by the way, that Mahathir himself helped push Anwar into prison for. Yeah. He has now said he's going to get a royal pardon for Anwar, and the idea would be that Anwar is released from prison and runs for prime minister and succeeds Mahathir, which was the plan 20 years ago, before these two men had a falling out and Anwar suddenly found himself in a world of legal trouble. So we're sort of seeing 20 years later a return to a narrative that in Malaysia is very familiar to people. And then the final point I'll make about Mahathir is he, more than anyone else, built the political establishment that Najib Razak, ended up looting to some extent. The party that he threw out of power, Mahathir, was in fact Mahathir's party, and he was the symbol of Malay political power in that country for many years. So there are just so many ironies in this particular turn of events. I'm sure people in Malaysia must find themselves just dizzy.
And he actually said this is the biggest mistake of his life, basically, when he admitted
supporting that. Could we step back to the Iran deal for 1 second before we keep moving? There's a comment I would like us to address about the Iran-Syria connection and what that connection really is. Jaber in Orlando emailed, "I'm not a fan of Trump, but Obama sacrificed Syrian civilians to Assad, Putin, and Khamenei to secure the Iran deal and protect his legacy. The slaughter and resulting world unrest we have seen for the past 7 years is the result of that decision." Natan Gutman, what do you think?
Well, clearly there's a lot of blame to share when we talk about how the West and how the United States abandoned Syria and just let this awful civil war go on for years. And frankly, no one sees an end in sight. So, yes, there is something to say about that. And also about the fact that once the Obama administration and the P5 plus one decided that they're going for a narrow deal, a nuclear-focused deal that takes care of only one aspect of the Iranian behavior, then clearly it did leave the chance open for Iran to expand its influence to other areas, whether it's Yemen or Syria. And it also clearly gave the Iranian Ayatollahs more money to spend on these adventures. So that could be a side effect or an unintended consequence of the Iranian nuclear deal. Definitely not the main reason for it. And definitely that's not the one thing that would change the trajectory of the Syrian war. What could do that is a broader Western involvement in the war.
But this idea that President Obama, in the commenter's words, sacrificed Syrian civilians to Assad, Putin, and Khamenei, that he basically made a deal with the devil, for lack of a better term.
Well, the rationale behind this deal with the devil was that you'll take care of the most acute problem with this so-called devil, the nuclear issue, and then once Iran is not nuclear, you'll be in a better position to pressure it or discuss other problems that you have. That, of course, never happened or has yet to happen, but that was the rationale behind it.
And the red line, too. Don't forget that. Mm-hmm. I mean, many people actually blame the Obama administration, and it's not just that, but the fact that they not just abandoned Syria, but they didn't think of it as geostrategic importance to the degree that it allows the Russians to come in, and the Iranians were there, but not to that degree of being militarily involved and having access to the Mediterranean.
A couple stories about freedom of expression around the world that we wanted to get to before we let you go. Let's start with Turkey, where its longtime president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, has been nothing short of controversial. During a speech he gave in parliament, President Erdogan stated, quote, "If one day our nation says enough, then we will step aside," unquote. sure enough, since he gave that speech on Tuesday, more than a million Turks have been flooding social media with the hashtag tamam, which means enough is enough. Nadia Bilbasi, this is kind of gutsy considering that President Erdogan is not a fan of the fourth estate in Turkey.
Completely. And but the irony of it as well is when it suits him, he can use the social media during the coup. Actually, he resorted to Facebook to appeal to his followers. But the interesting thing is now the Turks are holding him to his own words. He said, 15 years of you, President Erdogan, is more than enough. Tamam is tamam, and it's about time for you to step down. But of course, the AKP were not going to take it. And they were saying, okay, guys, use the social media to protest you wanted to do to bring the presidency down, but face us on election day in the in the polling station because we're going to win. And actually, President Erdogan has brought the date closer to almost by a year to have the election in Turkey in June 24th, I believe. So people definitely, Turkey has a very bad record when it comes to freedom of expression, prisoners, political prisoners, etc. And he actually used the coup as an excuse to purge so many opponents, including Fethullah Gul, his followers, the military, the PKK, and the Kurds part is not necessarily the PKK, but anybody who's on the Kurdish side of the contesting the election, he will say they're linked to terrorist organizations, they're supporting the PKK, etc. So it was really ironic in a way to see the Turks using this word and becomes like a trending worldwide, not just in Turkey.
Right.
Tamam.
You asked us to say it.
Because khalas, enough is enough.
You asked us to say it. And Mark, speaking of the election, which is coming up in the next month, do we have any sense of what that might look like? I mean, how confident is Erdogan's party that he will win?
Well, one of the advantages for him of moving the date up the way he did is it sort of caught the opposition off guard and ended up fragmenting them. So there's a lot of anger about that. So I think he's probably confident, despite all this restiveness in the society, that if he can continue to keep the opposition parties on the back foot, that he probably manages to stay in power. And that's obviously why he did move the date up.
The joke in Turkey is he was a mayor of Istanbul, which is a huge city of 20 million people. Then became the prime minister. Now he wants to become he's a president with executive power. And the next step, he wants to be the sultan. He wants to bring the Ottoman Empire back. Mm-hmm. That's the joke.
Kind of a joke, but you know, to his critics, there feels like a joke. Absolutely. With a lot of truth to it. Let's keep going and talk about Vietnam. This week, a court in Vietnam sentenced a Facebook user to 4.5 years in prison for posts that were deemed as anti-government. Police raided the home of Boy Vo, who's a 56-year-old man, finding 57 online posts that allegedly included anti-state propaganda and incited terrorist violence against the government. Natan Gutman, what do we know about this? I mean, Vietnam has become a bit more open in some areas. It's become known for being a relatively friendly place for some LGBT travelers. What do we know about the actual posts and what they say about free speech in Vietnam?
We don't know much. We know the way they were described in the court filings, that they encouraged people and terrorists and to create public panic and defamed the government and, of course, the ruling party, the ruling Communist Party. It isn't really clear what exactly this person said. But what is known is that even though Vietnam is opening up to the West in terms of tourism and economy, in terms of its domestic freedom of speech, not much has changed. And there is a crackdown on social media and an attempt to make sure that this opposition that is oppressed in other ways doesn't pop up through social media.
Let's head now to China. The British children's cartoon Peppa Pig is globally known on television. Now Peppa Pig is an internet icon in China, but for the wrong reasons. So far, China has deleted more than 30,000 Peppa Pig videos on its social media platform, TikTok, claiming that Peppa Pig is too, quote-unquote, gangster for society. Not gangsta, gangster. If you're unfamiliar with Peppa Pig, here's a clip.
Pig. This is my little brother George. This is Mummy Pig. And this is Daddy Pig. Peppa Pig. Whee! Look at me.
That's a clip from Peppa Pig. Sounds gangster to me. Mark, what is this really about?
I'm not sure there's a lot to add to that clip. If the future largest economy in the world and global superpower is worried about the effect of what we just heard, it says a lot about the depth of their insecurity, lack of confidence in their own people. This seems to be maybe more an example of self-censorship since the site went ahead and did it. But it happens within the context of a central government that has just been ruthless and relentless in cracking down on all forms of subversion on the internet. And I guess they are now classifying Peppa Pig under the category of subversion.
Before we go, as promised, we've done stories about Sweden to end the Friday News Roundup for 2 weeks in a row now. We can't break the streak. We're three-peating today, ladies and gentlemen, because much of the world this weekend will be watching the international song contest called Eurovision. It's completed its lineup of 26 contestants. They face off for this year's crown on Saturday. More than 200 million people typically tune in. The finalists this year are from Serbia, Moldova, Hungary, Ukraine, Australia, Norway, Denmark, and
Sweden.
It is one of the most successful countries in the Eurovision Song Contest. It's won 6 times, including in 2012 and 2015, and we guarantee you know one of the winners. ABBA won Eurovision in 1974 with Waterloo. Sweden.
Do
it all
love
comes
Sweden?
Back to Sweden.
But if I can add on that
briefly,
the favorites in the gambling are actually Cyprus and Israel, which comes to show you that even small countries can win the Eurovision.
Okay, All right, we'll give Israel a shot this year. Natan Gutman of Israeli Public TV, Nadia Bilbasi of Al Arabiya, and Mark Landlord of the New York Times. Thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Joshua Johnson. Enjoy your weekend, and thanks for listening. This is 1A.